हरिः ॐ सहना भवतु सहना भुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः ॐ जय श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानन्द श्री अद्वैत जगदाधार शिव हरि गौर भक्तवृन्द हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे
We're on topic 10.4.
Rules of good conduct.
Discourse
4.
Okay, for what? What for in the number?
Discourse 4, topic 10.
Okay, well that's the thing. Okay, it's the 10. Because the outline goes by the topics, not the discourses. Okay. 10 which...
Oh,
so we just started at 10.1. Okay. So the duties of a snatika. So now it's been described. So it's being built up on top of each other. Right? This is the important point, is that whatever's been before, that is there and it remains, and then it moves on and adds more. Right? So even you go into vanaprastha sannyas, that there are still the elements of the grihastha ashram that are applicable. All the character, all the ways of looking at things, the attitude, the philosophy, basic things of culture and etiquette, those all remain, right? Only the specifics of the grihastha ashram, of the duties of living with the women, woman dealing with children, you know, economics, those things are specific for the ashram. But all the culture, philosophy, character, interaction, those basic, you know, human duties, those all remain. Just like in the grihastha ashram, it's not that what was taught in the brahmacharya ashram was dropped. That's a major mistake. One feels that, okay, I control my senses of brahmacharya, now it's grihastha, they don't have to bother. And then it creates havoc. No, that continues. You just add into it now the duties of dealing with a woman and this and that. So women and that, and the household life, children, so therefore that's added. But still, the senses are controlled, the study of the scriptures, all these different things go on. Does that make some sense? So, that is a very fundamental point, because you'll see as they go on, they'll always say that, you know, these and other duties one must perform, or one must do all these rules that are mentioned before. Does that make some sense? So this is a very essential thing, is to understand the difference between the principles of varnashram that everybody functions on, and then the details of the specific ashram. Right? Because just because it's explained in the grihastha ashram section does not mean it's exclusively for grihasthas. If it's philosophy, character, you know, sense control, dutifulness, no, they don't. Like that. It talks about interaction with women, you know, conceiving a child, okay, that's specific for the ashram. Like that. But other things like the grihastha shouldn't sleep in the same bed with his wife, he shouldn't see her, you know, undressed, he shouldn't see her put on a couch, all these things, that's for anybody. You know? But it's mentioned about the grihastha because he's living there and he might directly see that on a daily basis if he doesn't know about it. But for everybody else, then they know to avoid those things. You know, because then, you know, the women put out extra energy at that time, and that's what attracts them. It means the woman herself, means one cannot say that, bag of mucus bile and air is attractive, even though it may have all the mucus bile and air in all the right places. but it's still unattractive. It's the energy of the soul and that energy of the soul interacting with the surrounding that makes it attractive. Does that make sense? Like that. Otherwise, it's not. It's dead matter. So the point is during certain times, women emit more energy, and that might create attraction. Like when they dress, then they're very into how they look and that, so they'll be projecting their energy into their clothes and with their eyes and everything like that. When they're putting things on the unguents on their body, they'll do that because they'll project it into the skin, the experience. This makes sense? For women, experience is the thing. What it's like, what it smells, what it tastes like, the whole atmosphere, the mood, like that. Men is more like what's getting done. How is it getting done? What will be the result of doing it? But for women, those are secondary. For them, it's the experience is the main. While for men, the experience is secondary. Right? It means they want a good experience, but it means if it came to a bad job and some experience, or a good job and maybe less experience, they tend towards the good job because the feeling of accomplishment, well done, you've applied your knowledge, you've worked it out, you know how to run it, you know how to control it. So therefore it's more of control, while the women it's more of attachment. But every jiva is in the material world with the Purusha Bhava of I'm the controller and I'm the enjoyer. Just this more prominent control in the men or the sense of I. And with the women it's more mine. You know? Like that. Does that make some sense? You know, it's like the man, it's like I am, you know, this is my how, is my I, then this is a manifestation of my I-ness. You know? Like that. I guess you would have to put an H and then a 10. But the women, it's mine, and then from that, there's my prestige, my her sense of I. You understand? The approach is different. In other words, the man goes from I to mine, and the woman goes from mine to I. Does that make sense? So the field's the same. So that's why there's the compatibility. Even though men and women basically on every point are opposites, but because the field is the same, the desires are the same, but the approach to them and which is prominent and which is primary and secondary, that's different. Does that make some sense? So that's why then it appears that there should be a nice cooperation, but there's not because they're different species. So unless one knows the science, then one can't match them. Does that make sense? So that's why then all these rules are here. So then for any particular thing that's going on, then wherever is the prominent place that it's dealt with, means a brahmachari also has to be careful not to bump into, you know, the women when they're dressing or doing these things or unclothed or like that. But it's not like a daily occurrence for him. It may happen now and again, and he just knows that this is something to avoid. But the grihastha, this could be a daily occurrence. Does that make sense? If you live in the same room with a woman, and it's a natural thing that you take a bath and you dress and undress and this, there's every chance you'll see. So therefore, if it's known that this is not to be done, the women will be more careful, the men will be more careful. The men will keep themselves busy so they're not looking, and the women will keep themselves in some way, either somewhere else, or if there's you only have one room like that, they'll be more careful. They'll turn around. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? So that means, in other words, there's that carefulness. So because that is, they'll deal with it the most. It's the most prominent for them. Therefore, it explained in that section. Does this make some sense? Just like the brahmachari, his respect of the guru, his study of the scriptures is the most prominent for him. It means every devotee respects their guru, and every devotee studies the scriptures. But that's all a brahmachari does. Right? He lives with the guru all day. The grihastha doesn't. Right? He studies, you know, this much every day. He has to. That is his duty. While the grihastha will pick his time and fit it in, but if something more important comes up, some economic or social consideration, then it will be put aside. But the brahmachari, you know, all economic, social, everything else is put aside for the study. Does that make sense? So therefore, all the things, our rules on study and that, those are all explained in connection with the brahmachari. Right? And for the sannyasi, then we see is that the point is that seeing things, how to become detached from the material world, not getting caught up in justice, this whole idea of I and mine and all that. So that's their prominent, that's how they view everything, look at everything, see everything, judge everything. So therefore those elements are explained there, though they apply to everyone. Right? But the Vanaprastha, how one can actually function without anything in the material world. Control the senses, no facility, this and that. That's their prominent thing, right? For the sannyasi, it's not, I don't have facility, or I have to reduce the facility. No, it's the philosophy behind it. Because then whether you have facility, doesn't have facility, it doesn't matter. Because for preaching, you may need facility. But, so the prominence is on the focus of the material world doesn't have anything to offer. It's illusory. Does that make some sense? There's a subtle difference there. Right? So the Vanaprastha, it's actually, I've been living with facility, and now consciously I'm going to reduce that. You know what I'm saying? Not that the sannyasi is not being careful in reducing it, not that the grihastha is not saying, hey, we're getting too much stuff, or this is getting too out of hand, and that they're trying to keep it in line, or the brahmachari is not doing it. But it's not the prominent thing. The Vanaprastha, that's the prominent thing, pulling out of the material element, from that side. By things. And while the sannyasi is dealing with by concept. It means you have the house, you're giving up the need for the house by giving up the house. The sannyasi is giving up the concept that houses are even needed. Right? So whether they live in a house or don't live in a house, it doesn't matter because the concept and need of it is not there. Well, the Vanaprastha, that need has been there as a grihastha, and now he's addressing it and reducing it. By learning to live without it. And then once he's learned to live without it, doesn't matter if he lives in it or not. Does that make sense? Like the Vanaprasthas will stay in on the edge of the village. They don't go too far away. They can either be on the outer edge of the village or the inner edge of the forest. You understand? It means the farthest most houses in the village, the Vanaprastha can live there. Or he can live on the closest part of the forest outside the village. Does that make sense? But they have to be available because the grihasthas can go to them and this and that. Plus, then they can compare. If you're living out in the middle of the forest, nothing's there. That's one thing. If you're living on the edge where you're living with nothing everybody else still has, then it's in your mind. What's there? What's all these things? And then because you're doing that, then the grihasthas will come. You'll be able to preach your realizations, discuss it. It'll make it deeper for you. You'll still be able to practice those basic things that you've been doing, giving in charity and hosting guests and stuff like that. Not that you're from an economic development that is coming, but because of living in that way and the other grihasthas appreciating, they're going to give charity. They're going to bring food, they're going to bring things like that. And so then the extra is given away to others who are needy. Other vanaprasthas or the sannyasis or the brahmacharis or whoever is begging. Does that make some sense? So that's the principle, what's happening there. But the sannyasi, he can either be in the deep forest or he can be right in the city. He can be in the palace. You know what I'm saying? Means there's restrictions for brahmacharis dealing with women. There's restrictions for grihasthas dealing with women. But for the sannyasis, they can deal with women and it's not a problem. Right? Because they're preaching. Does that make sense? Their thing is that there's no need of women. So they can deal with them. Grihastha, there's need of women, so therefore they can only deal with them in a particular way. Does that make sense? Like that. Well, the sannyasi then, they can go onto the inside of the house and preach to the women and stuff like that. And just like the Brahmins can do that also. You see, Brahmins will go into the inner chambers of the palace and, teach the girls, do the different things and like that. That needs to be brahminical duties that would be done. But Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, Shudras, they can't go in there. It means if the Shudras of the household, then they're in there and they're only in there. They're not somewhere else. If they're in-house, they're only in-house. If they're out-house, they're not in the out-house. And if they're in the other parts of the palace, then they're there. They don't go in the inner chambers. Because you don't want them to cross, because what's inside, naturally they talk. Oh, what are the queens like? What do they look like? And then they'll get attraction. Then people want to go in there. Does that make some sense? So therefore, those who work inside don't leave inside. And those who don't work inside never go inside. So they're two different worlds. But the Brahmins, they can go in there. Right? So that those Brahmin men who are teachers and do ritual and different things like that, they can go into the inner palace. Like that. And the sannyasis can go in. But the others can't. Right? So therefore it's given these different elements. You know, unless someone's authorized. Like someone, a very good friend on that, you'd see like a Karna would go into the inner chambers of Duryodhana's house. Like that, because they were so close. But that's an invited friend. Then they may be going. Does that make some sense? So it's just where the natural restrictions are and where they're not. Like that. Like the area down where the women bathe. Okay, then the grihasthas can't be hanging out there. The brahmacharis can't be hanging out there. But the sannyasis, because they just wander, if they walk by there, it doesn't matter. Right? It means they won't stop there, of course, but it means if they walk by there or seen there, it's not a problem. Because they live out in the forest. So if they're moving along the bank of the river and they go by the place where the women's area, then it's not a problem. They keep going. But if a grihastha's down there, why is he down there? Because the grihastha's from the village know that's the women's area, so why is he there? Does that make sense? So there's all these details that you get from understanding what is the mood of each ashram, what is its purpose, what is it trying to attain. You know what I'm saying? What is the element that the particular ashram is adding to the, you know, life experience of the individual? So understanding that, then the whole system makes sense. Otherwise you're going to say, okay, these are the rules of brahmacharya, and that's all. So if you wanted to study modern, you took only the rules for brahmacharya and taught that the brahmacharis, you wouldn't get a complete picture. Like that. So, because there's a lot of elements that all the other, described in all the other ashrams, that also apply to the brahmachari. You know, same with the grihastha, same with the vanaprasth, mm-hmm. Same with the sannyas. You know, like if a sannyasi has a guest, he'll take care of him in the same way the grihastha would, but he has less facility. But the method is the same. Who is considered a guest is the same consideration. Who's not a guest is the same consideration. Does that make some sense? How you serve prasad, it doesn't matter what the ashram. But because the grihastha, they have to feed them. Right? Distributing food is part of their duty, so therefore it's described there. But anybody else who distributes food, like if some special guest is there at the guru's ashram and the brahmachari is helping serve, it'll be the same method, the same details, same rules. Does that make sense? You know, but instead of, you know, something more elaborately cooked or arranged by the grihastha, it may just be fruits and roots, you know, that are gathered in the forest. Does that make some sense? So that's always important to remember. So now we're going into the duties of the snatika, and you'll see some of them have broad consideration, some of them don't. But in any case, what's in that section must be done by the person in the section. Right? The grihastha section, that's to be done by grihasthas. Though there are elements that are done by everybody. You know what I'm saying? So therefore you have to perform the duties of the section, plus the duties that are there spread throughout the others, because that's the better place to explain it. Otherwise then you have this overlap. You know what I'm saying? That's the difficulty with the Western, because you would say, oh, but it's not clear. But then the Vedic rule is, does it allow you to study only part of the scripture? Yes or no? Right? It's considered improper dealing with the scripture. Because the scripture is a complete whole, and according to the conversation, what's trying to be gotten across, different points will be made at different places. So you'll take out one verse and say, see, here, this, but you have to make sure that that verse is representative of the whole work. There must be sangati, right? And you must be able to connect it with the other parts of the work, the other scriptures. Does that make some sense? So that's the difficulty. is that it has to be seen and it's complete. Now the Western thing would be taking everything that would deal with the Brahmacharya and put it one place, Eric Grihastha, like this. And there would be no overlap. Right? And if there is an overlap, then they would take all the ones that were and then stick them over in one. You know? But then you get an idea that this is only a rule for Brahmacharya, so therefore it's dropped. But this is a complete society, it's a fabric. Right? The cloth, you know, the threads go both ways. It's interwoven. So you have to understand the full fabric, then you understand what is how it's working. Then the individual threads make sense. Does that make sense? You have to understand. It means you understand what the fabric is for, how it's to be used, how to deal with the fabric. Then you can understand, okay, what kind of thread it is. It's single, it's double, you know, what's the twist on it, what's the thickness of the thread, how many threads per inch, what was the methods of weaving, was it straight, was it the zigzag, all these, does that make some sense? Those then make sense, but if you study all those and don't know how to deal with cloth or what the cloth's for, what's the meaning? So that's why it's always this descending approach. Because the ascending, you'll deal with all the little things, take the cloth, look at it, put it under the ion microscope, figure out its molecular structure, all these different things. But the Vedic is it descends. First you understand what is cloth, what is it for, how does it fit into the whole picture? Right? Then from there, then you figure out what are the details of the cloth. Right? Like the newest person knows Krishna is God. Right? Then he understands how he's God. You know, what is the material world? What is it? You know what I'm saying? It slowly, it all expands. But you have to know Krishna is God. I am Jiva. I am servant of God. Right? The process to attain God is through devotional service. The goal of that service and that relationship with God is love, prema. Understanding those, then you can expand it. But if you don't understand those, you can know the whole Vedic literature, and it's useless. Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya was such a person. He knew more scripture than anybody knew. Therefore, he was the biggest pundit, you know, of his day and probably even up to today. There's probably never been anyone as big as him. Right? One must remember he is Brihaspati. Right? So, you bring Brihaspati down here and he would be, in comparison, you know, a smart cookie, you know. Right? He's not going to be a slouch. Right? So, and he knew all the scriptures, but didn't know the conclusions. Therefore, it didn't make any sense. But when he spoke to Lord Chaitanya, Lord Chaitanya just gave him conclusion. He didn't bother with the detail. He already knew enough detail. Then it all fit into place. Right? Then he was the real then Bhattacharya. Right? Before that, he was Bhattacharya. It means, as a Brahmin, as one who knows and all that, then yes, he was very qualified. But the real purpose of Brahmanism is Vaishnavism. So then he became a real Brahman. Then he's the real Bhattacharya. The Bhattas are the high grade Brahmins. So Bhattacharya is the Acharya of high grade Brahmins. Like that. So then he becomes their guru. Right? And now as a Vaishnava, then he actually is, because then he's the guru of all the Brahmins. Does that make some sense? Okay, so then duties of the snataka. So maintaining purity in the performance of occupational duties. So this is a very important point, because for a Brahmin, the most essential thing is purity, right? Because if you are not pure, how one will move on? Right? Because if you're not pure, you get stuck with that impurity. That's an anartha. So the idea is brahminical life means it's pure, because you're trying to attain to understanding Godhead, who is the supreme pure. So therefore, whatever he does, it must be consistent. Let him not seek wealth through pursuits to which men cleave. Now it means the endeavor for getting wealth shouldn't be through the mediums that people are attached to. The brahminical occupational duties are that work within the realm of detachment. Right? Like you have the conversation between, who is it? Devi Ayani and I think Sukanya. Not Sukanya. Sharmista. Devayani is Sharmista. So Devayani is the daughter of Sukracharya, who is the guru of Vishaparva. Right? He's the king of the demons. Right? I think Vishaparva became Jarasandha. Right? In the pastime. But Vishaparva, he's one of the, I think one of the, he might even be one of the sadhyas, one of the heads of the particular species. Right? And he's in a sadhya, like you have Kuvera is the sadhya of the yakshas. Means when you say yakshas, then you can with confidence say Kuvera, because he is the epitome of yakshahood. Right? So like this, every species, all these, the Gandharvas, the Yakshas, the Rakshasas, the Kinaras, the Kimpurushas, they all have their sadhya. Right? All the demigods, the Siddhas, the Charanas, they all have their sadhya. Like that. Does that make some sense? So there they... How do you get into... Oh, so Vishaparva may be that within that group. Or he's very, very prominent. Vishaparva, because he's one of the, you know, maybe directly the sons of the Prajapatis. So then he's the head of the demons, and Sukracharya is his, you know, prime minister, like that, or not prime minister, Rajguru, his guru. So then their two daughters are discussing, one day they get angry at each other, because that whole thing when they were taking bath, and then Indra wanted to have some fun because they were going to some program at maybe Brahmaloka or something. So they were going by, and Shiva was coming, and Indra thought, I can have some fun. So he went in and took the form of wind and mixed all their clothes up. And just then Shiva went by in his bowl with Parvati, so all the girls feel embarrassed, you know, being there naked. So they all immediately run, and they, you know, you don't think at that time, you just work instinct, that they just know where they always put their clothes, because girls are totally territorial. So if they always put their cloth here, that's always their spot. And then where they go into the water, that's their spot to go in the water. And you know where they stand in the water, that's their spot in the water. So like that. So they just instinct, just immediately run to their spot and grab their clothes and put them on. But when that happened, then when he went by, then it started the whole thing. Devayani was saying, Sarmishta had taken her clothes. You know, she starts to think, how is it the Kshatriyas are taking the clothes? You know, you're rising up, you know, trying to take your superior's clothes. Like that. And then Sarmishta, you know, because she's Kshatriya, she doesn't necessarily brook insults very kindly. So then she immediately said, you know, what are you talking about? Says, your father lives by begging. He's dependent upon my father. My father's independent. He gets his own money, does his own work. He's an upstanding gentleman. Your father just lives off of others. Like this, you know. So like this, it went back and forth a bit. And then that got back to Sukracharya. You know, and then Devayani's completely flipped out. She won't come back into the palace. And then if she doesn't come back, because Sukracharya is responsible for her, that means he'll have to move out, and he'll have to live out there in the forest. And then, you know, when it's understood, you know, Vishaparva understands, you know, what's going on here. He's going to lose his guru, because only because of him are the demigods ever successful in winning any of the battles with the demigods. So then he just says, okay, then what to do? And so then they work it out that Sarmishta means Vishaparva's daughter has to become a maidservant for Devayani, you know, to make her humble. Like that. And so the king, even though it'll pain him, because that's his daughter, but better than losing the whole kingdom over one girl who, you know, who's being, you know, impudent and just speaking against the scriptures. What Devayani said was true, but, you know, proud, you know. So it was, you know, that kind of diminutive mood is not good. But it's at least according to Shastra. And what Sarmishta said, it has an element of the Shastra in that the Kshatriya and the Vaishya, then they have to be independent. But the Brahmin also is independent. So she's leaving out that part. So on her side, it's actually more, she's wrong. The other one, her attitude is wrong, which is not good. Brahmins can't be proud. But the other one actually means, by according to the Dharma Shastra, had half right, but the other half, applying it that the Brahmins are not independent, that is wrong. Because the point is, according to the Shastras, the world belongs to the Brahmins. And the Brahmins, because they don't want to deal with you know, get so involved with the material energy, then they give it to the Kshatriyas. And then the Kshatriyas then can give out portions to the Vaishyas and take their tax and all that. So the only reason the Kshatriyas function is because the Brahmins have given them that facility. So she's missed that point, you know. That, you know, her father's doing independent only because of the mercy of Sukracharya. Otherwise he wouldn't be independently making his money. Does that make some sense? So because of that, then she, you know, needed to be put in, corrected. So it was understood for some time that she would be a maidservant. With the time, you know, it would go away.
That's
not Brahma.
Indra. Indra.
You got
any reaction?
No, it's just having fun. Because he wanted to start that. It's political, that's all. It's politics. So that's the field. You know, that's why Brahmins don't get involved. It just gets too grungy, you know. You know, that kind of thing. How did we get into that? That was a tangent to prove a point that we were actually discussing. Oh, purity. Well, it was something to do with the purity of making their money.
The purity is most essential.
Oh yeah, not doing things that others are connected to. So therefore, the Brahmins' things are detached. They beg, they glean. They perform their services. People give charity. Like they perform a sacrifice, someone just gives charity. They don't charge a fee. You know what I'm saying? So that's the whole thing. They're not running their economics the way others do who are attached to the results. They're running it that they're dependent upon the Lord. So whatever the Lord wants to send them, that's what they're going to get. You know, if you tell the person, you've done such a nice, you know, either yagya or whatever, I'd like to give you something. Yeah, so how much should I give you? No, you give whatever you want. So that can get you either way more than what would be a normal amount, or it could get you way less. You know, you just spent the whole day, did all that, and they, oh great, and they give you 50 rupees, 100 rupees. Or they could go, that was so nice, they give you 10,000. You don't know. So that's the Brahminical. They just depend upon the Lord. Whatever they get, they know that's what they're supposed to get. They're not worried that, well, I should have charged him. No, they just know that if the person didn't had money but didn't give enough, that therefore I have to be more careful with the character. But if the person doesn't have money and he sincerely gave what he had and he just had 100 rupees, then that's gladly accepted. Like that. So that's that. Because it says that one should give less fees, you know. By giving less fees, then that will be bad for them. Means one should always give a fee that's appropriate if you're doing a special ritual. You see how much endeavor is there, how much time is spent, how much knowledge is required by the person to do that thing. If it's just a simple thing that, you know, any Brahmin could do, that's one thing. But if it's something only a specialized Brahmin can do, that's another thing. You know? So that's, you have to judge kind of in that way. Does that make sense?
The Brahmin judge.
Yeah, but that's it. That's why they have Brahmins to discuss with. You know, and that's, the Brahmins are detached, so that's another thing. They don't matter. You're discussing someone else's money, it doesn't matter. But also it's there. You learn that also by association. So in the Vedic culture, you'd know from your father, because he does those kind of yagyas, and you see what he gives, so then, and by the quality of the Brahmin. So you get an idea. If you don't have, then that has to be learned. It means you have to, if you want to make yogurt, you have to start with some yogurt. And then after that, then, you know, it continues. Okay, and then consistency of dress. So, consistency of his dress, speech, and thoughts. It means that according to his age, according to his position, according to what he's doing, everything, then there should be a consistency. Right? How he dresses, how he speaks, right? How he thinks, all that should be consistent. then that's proper, right? You don't have 60-year-old women trying to dress like 18-year-olds. You know, you wouldn't have that, or somebody who's uncultured trying to dress like somebody's cultured, like Kali Raj, he was dressing, you know, like a king. No, it was inappropriate. You know, so you get those kind of things. They should dress according to what is their standing. Older, you dress according to someone who would be older. Yes.
But the Purushottam Raj gave a class in Los Angeles last December,
mm-hmm.
and he said that one aristocratic Bengali lady,
mm-hmm.
she commented, you know, seeing the marriage breakups and so on and so forth. She said the problem in Islam is that the unmarried girls are dressing like married women, and the married women are dressing like widows.
Oh, I said widows. Oh, okay. Yeah, it means, point is they dress nice and they try to look very chaste and very, you know, lovely and attractive and, you know, like that, just very proper. And as soon as they get married, then you got the guy, then they don't bother anymore. You know, they look like slobs because they got what they want. So it's you know. And then if you say, no, but what, oh, that's Maya. So then why do you get married? Why do you want a house? That's Maya. Why do you want money? That's Maya. Why do you want children? That's Maya. But all of what they want, that's okay. But what the man wants, then that's mine. You know, so it's definitely a problem, because then that's the meaning of the raw, untrained feminine nature. It's just, you know, get what you.
You know. Mean.
Yeah, it means the men have the same problem, is that they will get what they want. The woman does service, she's submissive and everything, but then he doesn't necessarily take care of her needs. The subtleties and the emotions and that support. So it's the same problem. But, you know, it was there in that comment. It was just a woman was making the comment about how many women were behaving. So that's, you know, that's her right to say that. She's right. I mean, you see it. You see the married women, they look like slobs. And that's when the husband's around. It's one thing if the husband's not there and they look like that. That's fine. And then when the husband comes back, they dress properly. You know, if they say it's artificial, then it's artificial, then why have they call the colored saris? If it's no big deal, then just get white ones or get all the same. You know, just have white bead bags, white cholis, white, you know, petticoats and all that. And then you pick, you know, a suitable thing like that, you know, just like the plain Bengali, you know, white with a little red border, and just have, you know, 10 of those. Bus, finish. They'd never agree. You know? Never agree. You know? No, but, you know, you need variety, so then that means then there's something considered. So why are the women's, you know, emotional needs are, but not the man's? You know, so that's the difficulty. It's just lack of training and self-centered. And because of lack of training, one's self-centered. One only sees one's own world. The women think that the whole world functions like their world does. And of the women's world, their specific angle on it. But they're two different worlds. The men's world is different from the women's world. That's
how about the consistency and the dress code for us aspiring Vaishnavas? Because, I mean, it's not so fixed for us. I mean, in the Vedic times, you knew a king is wearing like this, and a brahmana is wearing like that, and brahmacharya is wearing this, but here it's kind of...
It's not so fixed, it just depends. Point is because the element of yukta vairagya, anything can be a gauge, but then you just have to see is, what does it project? You know? Means, what is the purpose? If the purpose is just pragmatics, then that naturally would pervade everything you do. So then just what's practical. And then what happens is then in the social consideration, just what's practical to get the job done, that's all they do. But because pragmatics is a Vaishya outlook, it's a bourgeois outlook, because the Brahmins and Kshatriyas are also pragmatic. But they consider that in this pragmatism that you must consider the philosophical, you must consider the social, the emotional, you know, the economic, the sense gratification, and the liberation. You have to consider all those. So the higher you go in the varnas, then the more is their view of practical. Right? While you get, while the business point is just what gets the economics. That's it. You know? I mean, so we're just talking this natural raw state. Somebody who's trained and devoted, they can adjust, but that's the field that one's working in. So then what happens is it gets it done, though. It may step on a few toes, but then what's the comment? But, you know, they're devotees, they're not supposed to get bent out of shape anyway. So then that's okay, but that's okay for someone who runs a go-down. It's not okay for someone who manages and is responsible to people's life. A temple president with that attitude will not be successful. He may make a nice temple, have plenty of money, have nice facilities, but whether the devotees that he's working with are satisfied, that's a totally different picture. Because he's not considering the individual's, you know, personal needs and emotions. But then one can say, well, they could want anything. But then what do the scriptures say? So you have to keep them in control. Not only do you facilitate it, but you keep it in control. Just like that, the husband. He facilitates the woman's needs, but keeps them in control. Because there is a path of the woman's nature. And that path has its religious form and its irreligious form. So therefore, they're kept on the path, but what is the needs of the path has to be supplied. So there's always a balance. And the problem with the modern conception is that it doesn't deal with that balance, because it doesn't balance it with what is the scriptures say and what is you know, what are the facilities you get and what's the restrictions you get. So therefore it's either all Maya or it's all you know, natural, why we should restrict. So both of these are modern concepts. Like that. And this modern concept has existed eternally. Mana makes that, I think, in the 12th chapter. There's that all these non-Vedic ideas, they're all of modern date. You know, they're contemporary, that happened today. People think like that today, and then the wind changes, and then they think something else. So he says, this concept of the modern, you know, like devotees will say, it's modern now, and we have to think differently. Modern's been going on for a million years. Modern, the definition of modern is, it's not Vedic, that's all. Because you talk about the Pandavas, you talk about Ramachandra, you talk about, you know, go back farther, you know, the Diti and Kasyapa, or Brahma, or Narad. I mean, you're talking about sometimes millions or billions or trillions of years difference. But you just count it as one time period, because it's eternal. It is timeless. It's the cutting edge of the future. It's what's happening today, and it's the tradition of the past. You know? Does that make some sense? Because it's eternal. So anything outside of that is modern. There's always been the modern think, and the modern think always thinks is special. You know, that's guaranteed. They always think that they're special, different, unique, don't fit in, have to have their own considerations. Yeah, it's just like it's Malecha Yavana culture. And there's always been Malechas and Yavanas. And they always think in the same way. There's no difference. So that's the principle, is that it's understood is that therefore one has to actually become trained like that. It's not automatic. The maverick is good, right? The American thing is the maverick. You know, without training, without this, just that feeling, he just goes forth and claws his way from the bottom to the top and is successful and everything comes out, and he was, even though the methods he used were wrong, but, you know, the end was right, and so therefore it's all good and all this and all that. And, you know, everybody, you know, sits around and is happy about it. Like that. But the point is that it has to be based on some standards. Because there, even you take that, there's some strict standards going on here.
They have some codes.
They have a code. It means even though you use, non-textbook methods, you still have to get the result. You don't get the result, then it was wrong. Mm-hmm. It has to be. And you can step on people's toes, but at the end of the day, then it all has to work out. You can't leave anybody's toes unstepped on. I mean, the stuff. And if they are stepped on, I mean, if they don't straighten out, even though you told them, oh, I'm sorry, I insulted you, I did this and that, broke your trust, did everything in the book that is absolutely forbidden, and then I come and say, I'm sorry, and then you that moment just have to, yes, like that, then you're a nonsense, because you're just an attached, you know, whatever it is, self-centered. So they have some underlying things that are exceedingly fixed. So when they talk about broad-minded, subjective, you know, the whole, you know, all that, no, they're more rigid and bigoted than the Vedic principles. Because the Vedic can handle from topmost Brahmins down to the, you know, the uncultured tribals. Everybody has their place in the culture. All of them are accommodated, though their lifestyles or everything's different, because there's an overall thing that is there. But in the modern, no. It means their little sphere of influence and movement, they're together and everybody else is out of it. So it's an extremely narrow, narrow vision. But the thing is because they're so proud of it, it's presented as the broadest and most, you know, welfare and best for everybody, and, you know, it's always a one-way street. There's no relationship. It's just impersonal. One-way street, just they have their codes which ways the roads are going. You know? Like that. You know, so it's... You have that thing. So that's the difficulty with the modern. Is because it's not Vedic, it doesn't have any eternal standards. And because of that, therefore it's speculative how it would be applied. You know? Yes.
Also, they can't respect their history because they're always doing something new.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, whatever was previous was bad or wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So then they have to like always adjust history.
Yeah.
They can't respect the past.
Yeah, that's true.
Previous leaders or anything, people fought them or
them. And they call this progressive knowledge.
Yeah, it's progressive. But the problem is then, why work so hard? Because you work so hard to do something for everybody's benefit, but after 10 years, 20, 50, 100, then they'll say what you did was stupid. You know? So then you're a whole... But at the same time as there's authority, but at the same time as there's not. So it's like the impersonalist, where they accept a guru, they take initiation, they surrender, they serve, and one day they reject and they become the guru. So it's the same principle. So it's impersonalism from top to bottom, through and through. There's nothing personal about it, really. Just it has, nowadays, the New Age has some personal overtones, you know, just the tone of voice, and, you know, that you deal nicely and are considerate and kind and feel about it and all that. But actually, if you look at it, the system that they apply is very inconsistent. Extremely inconsistent. You know, it's everybody accepts it, so it's vox populi, so everyone moves that way, so no one notices. But then when it moves that way, then like Plod was saying, it's just what it was before is, oh, we saw that was wrong, so therefore we moved it this way. The pendulum was all the way on the left. That's wrong, so we moved it all the way on the right. So everything on the left is wrong. But then they find out that the right doesn't work, so then we move to the left. You know, so like that. It's unfortunate. It's understood it will happen. Because if you don't have a standard, it will be speculative, it will have all these anomalies to it. But like what he says there, then that means, what does that mean? What is the inherent outcome of that? The inherent outcome of that is then your previous generation is not considered and is out of it. Therefore your parents, your teachers, you know, whatever is the administration that's there, therefore you have to have countercultures, revolutions, and rebellions, you know, like this. I remember I was in one yatra, where I thought this was quite funny. And I was observing the particular, and they used to, for the yatra, then they had, you know, some leaders. And it was set up in a very bureaucratic way. It was kind of dressed, you know, it was kind of like basically based on the probably at that time you would say the you know, communistic, you know, the Russian
Politburo.
Yeah, yeah. So they had the bureau. You know, you always went by and there was a little paper on the door that said bureau. And there was always meetings going on and everything happened. And those bureau members, you never saw them do anything other than have bureau meetings. They'd be up all night, never attend any programs, never do anything, because they were always busy, you know, in the bureau. And then, and you know, I noticed that from that, then they weren't so dynamic, so then they didn't, they weren't as inspiring to the devotees as those devotees who were actually doing the service that the bureau had decided that they would do. Does that make sense? It means the ones that were actually carrying out and practically applying what the bureau said to do, then they were inspiring to the devotees, very nice and pleasant and all that. So then I went to the you know, kind of basically the leaders of who are actually in charge of the bureau, and I said, hey, why don't you, you know, put the bureau members to work, and the ones that are actually doing the work, make them the bureau members, because they nice qualities and all that, and then he'll be able to be inspiring and all that. And then I just got back this really, you know, straightforward, blunt answer. It says, that's what we did. Whoever you put in that position, then they become like that, and then the other side. They said, yeah, we already did that one.
That's communism for you.
Yeah, so it was such a funny.
They say that the working class should be in charge, but they still have this elite class.
They have to. Means what is it? Everyone according to their ability, everyone according to their need.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's nice. It sounds great. It sounds fabulous. Who's to decide what's the ability and what's their need?
Right.
That's the point. Therefore, the bureau. So in other words, they just have kshatriyas and shudras. And because there's no vaishyas, there's no economics. So you can't run it. You know? Like that. And you know, I guess Marx was their Rajguru, so they have one Brahmin, but other than that, all other Brahmins seem to be able to like that.
It was actually quite astounding that from the communists took over and until the Berlin Wall fell, that's like 70 years, they actually managed to run that country. It was one of the most powerful, richest countries in the whole world.
Mm-hmm.
And they managed to run it down into the ground.
Mm-hmm. Oh, before they started?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, with the Tsar, they didn't like the Tsar, but under the Tsar, it was the most powerful, rich, you know, country.
And biggest.
Yeah.
The biggest country.
And after the communists took over, it took them just 70 years to completely ruin the economy, completely ruin the land, everything, you know. Now they're just, you know, poverty stricken.
Yeah. Funny. Yeah. These things are going on.
It just
on.
Shows in the Bhagavad Gita, if you don't do sacrifice,
yeah,
if you don't cooperate with nature, you're just going to get punished.
Yeah. That, and also they don't know the social system. It means,
yeah,
the people that make the economics are the vaishyas, and they, you know, dispose of them all. You know?
Yeah.
So that's the difficult. So therefore the need of not speculating, of understanding what are the principles and then functioning on that. Then, of course, one has to use the intelligence and all that for time, place, and circumstance and apply it. But time, place, and circumstance doesn't mean it's thrown out. That's the difficulty with the maverick. The maverick is you just throw it out, you look at it, you come up with your own thing, get it done. Even if it breaks all the standards, as long as it gets the end result, that's all that matters. But that's okay, that's for a Vaishya mentality. But the Kshatriya mentality, is still, it has to get it done. It has to be practical. But it still has to be according to the scriptures. And same with the Brahmins. So that's the difference. So any management books now you see, they're basically dealing with Vaishya management. They're not Kshatriya or Brahminical management. So they don't, they have underlying eternal codes within them because they're working. But they don't, how do you say, they don't fully address the problem. It means there's only one Arthashastra. Right? And for the Chinese, they have one scripture, right? Sun Tzu. You know, in Europe you have Machiavelli. You know, and then now it's a modern, I heard this some other person, I forget what his name is, that they most of the armies work off of that.
Although this is Chinese guy.
No. There's another. This newer guy is Chinese.
No, this very old Chinese guy.
Yeah, yeah. But I'm saying Sun Tzu is still used today, or Japanese have the five rings. Mushashi's five rings. So they just need one because the principles are there. But nowadays, every couple of weeks, a new management book comes out, a new how to because the point is they're only considering part of it. So where it's weak, then someone else observes a weakness and then tries to fill that gap by writing a new book. But then they also miss something. So then you can just go on and on and on. But you see, those who stick to tradition, those who have that feeling of tradition, hearing from authority, maintaining, then they have one book that says it all. And then it's just a matter of your intelligence to apply it. And that's the thing, is that they're trying to take Vaishya management and apply it to Kshatriya and Brahminical spheres, which doesn't work like that. But you see is that you can take these administrative books and apply them to business. Right? The Japanese businessmen were so successful because they could understand how to take the five rings and apply it in business. What's the principle? It's just like, okay, here's what Mushashi says. It says you should always face, when you're fighting, the north, the northeast, or basically the north is what you want to face. And then depending upon where the sun is, the east or west. In other words, you want to keep your back to the sun. Right? Because if you have your back to the sun, one, the person can't see your face really nice because of the contrast. So they can't see your eyes, so they can't tell what you're going to do. And two, the sun's in his eyes, so he can't look very carefully and all that. That's one element. A subtler element is energy comes in from the east and from the north, so therefore you're in the powerful position. While you're facing the south, you lose energy. That's the more subtle. Okay. So, one would say, okay, that's for fighting. Okay. That's okay. But in business, you have to keep yourself where they can't see your moves and what you're going to do. You have to put yourself in a strong position. Right? So then those things apply. Then the more you get into it, the more you can see the nature. What is the sun? Sun is, where you're getting energy from. You have to be close to it and be back to it. So then they'll be bewildered by it. Does that make some sense? So these kind of things is that they contemplate this all day, therefore they find more and more subtler nuances with it. And so they can apply it there. So it goes down. That's Anuloma. The higher knowledge can apply for down, but the lower one doesn't apply up. Right? Because what's lower is the detail of the higher. The principles are all set, established at the top. Then the principles then have details for the top, details for below that, details below that, details below that. Now if you take details from the bottom, and then you try to then find from that the original principles that they're from, and therefore then try to give details for the top, it's not at all efficient. So that's a difficulty. So therefore, the Brahmin can't do anything for creating economic development that will be based on that it's going to take him further into the material energy. Right? And then it makes the point of study. It means he shouldn't do anything that's going to reduce his study. It means he's not going to study like a brahmachari all day because he has his duties as a grihastha. But he has study. He must do his study. Because if he doesn't study, his knowledge won't stay alive. It's not alive, he's not going to be inspired. It's not inspiring, people aren't going to want that association. So if they don't want his association, then they're naturally also not going to want to give things to him, interact with him, gain knowledge from him. Therefore, what's his meaning of his life as a Brahmin? So he shouldn't take up an occupation that ruins his study. It may have to be minimalized, but it can't destroy it. It can't replace it. Like that. Vaishyas can do that, yes. Kshatriyas is best they don't, but they could. Because they have Brahmins there that they're going to discuss. So the Brahmins are studying, then they discuss with the Kshatriyas. So the Kshatriyas continue their contemplation and, cultivation of their scriptural knowledge by that discussion. And then Vaishyas, when they have special programs and yajnas and all those things, then they have the same they have the same opportunity, but it's less often because they're not always doing that. But the Kshatriyas always have Brahmins in their courts. But the Brahmin has to study, yes.
How does that apply to, let's say, does it apply to ISKCON preachers that the sannyasis have such an intense schedule?
But they're discussing.
Right.
Point is they're having an intense schedule discussing the knowledge. So therefore, by speaking, then it improves their understanding.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they do get to study more, then that then adds more and more to it. But the point is that one must be involved in one aspect of the study and teaching. Best is both. But at least for there, because they're in that ashram, so therefore the teaching is more important. Like that, because that is the purpose of that ashram. With the grihastha, it's both to study and teach. The brahmacharya is to study. You know, he may do a little teaching. Like that. So it would still function. Like that. But you generally see someone who preaches so much that they have an opportunity to study, then they'll take it. And they'll get the most advantage out of it. They can go very, very deep. Like that. Because, And let him never neglect sacrifice. May he should never give up sacrifice because of, you know, economic considerations. That must always be there. So that means for us, the chanting, you know, must always go on. Like that. Okay, then receiving guests, there's no real details here. Begging, rules of conduct. So receiving guests means that there's a whole discussion on what is a guest. You know, how do you identify what's a guest? Like a close friend is not a guest. Though you'll take care of him, facility, but it's a different consideration. Here, guest means respectable. That when they come, the whole house stops and centers around them. But a friend comes, it's just they come as part of the house. Like the guest, you feed him first, and the host afterwards eats. But a friend, you know, you sit with a friend and eat. You know, like that. So you may offer the same facilities, but it's done in friendship, not in reverence. So that's it.
Yeah. In the modern world, friends, so it doesn't really matter.
In the modern world, they're all friends.
In the modern world, friends, everyone's equal.
Yeah, so then it's a problem because then there's no respect. And then, but at the same time, is then it drops the standard. Because if you know how to respect, then you know how to live. You know? Means someone who knows how to eat knows how to serve. Mm-hmm. Someone who doesn't know how to eat doesn't know how to serve. So therefore, someone who can't respect, that doesn't actually know what are the items of life. Like, you respect somebody, then you know that you're offering them nice food, nice facilities, you know, the comforts, the different things like that. You don't know how to do that, you don't actually know how to live. You know what I'm saying? So, you generally you'll see that many times. You go into houses, and they don't know how to eat, they don't know how to cook, they don't know how to serve. But they're cooking and eating and serving. But it has nothing to do with the standards, you know. Right? So many times you're sitting there, they're right there in front of you, they got a full pot of stuff, they're expecting you to eat, but they won't put it on your plate. You have to ask for it. Your plate's empty. You know, and they're just absorbed in the conversation because that's why they invite the people over, just for the interaction. But they're not considering that, okay, they're getting their interaction, but what about you invite them over for lunch? What about they're eating it? They didn't just come over for the interaction. You know, that's part of it, but since you've asked them to eat, then they want to eat. That's their focus. No, but is that, and then, oh, you want something more? You know, it's like that. You know, oh, do you, you know, that kind of, oh, can I give you more? So now it's a normal thing in a culture thing. No, I'm fine. So therefore, you go away hungry. Because they don't know how to eat. And so therefore, they don't know how to serve. And they can't tell that, okay, you know, means is that thing, oh, you could eat anything in these pots. No, but there's certain things go with certain things. Therefore, you know, if you have some chutney on your plate that goes with the, you know, with the pakoras, and there's no pakoras, then that might mean that you need some pakoras. Or you have pakoras and no chutney, you might need that. But no, you have to ask for everything. That's culture. Yeah, you just ask. Yeah, I'll tell you. And so those who are from the same background, for them it's no problem. Yeah, hey, give me more of that. That was really great, you know, like that. No, a little bit more. No, hey, more, give more. You know, like that. You know, but But the point in the refined thing, if it's rasa, there it's okay. It's my senses and the prashad on the plate, but the interaction with the other person. No, we're just straightforward. We don't get caught up in all these little subtleties. Yeah, you don't get caught up in any kind of subtleties, therefore your wife's going nuts. Like that. And you can ask her, and she'll say, the guy has no sensitivity. Like that.
What about guests? Is a guest someone who is invited?
Can be. Means if it's more social, it can. Means here, someone, technically speaking, a guest, see, means atiti, means someone who comes without asking.
Anyone who turns up.
But anyone who turns up is a qualified Brahmin. They're atiti.
That's good to know. Well, what about people you don't actually don't like?
No, but but they're all hosted. But it's just that it's hosted out of the proper pleasantness and all that, but it's not done with reverence and respect. Your whole house doesn't stop for them. You know? But when an atiti, who is a qualified Brahmin, shows up like that, that person then is dealt with, you know, that all considers the house stop and it just centers it, how to take care, how to host them, how to do all those different things. That's atiti. But a friend or an acquaintance or some business thing or that, the basic principles would be the same. You know, feed them, give them a place to sit, you know, this and that, or whatever it is according to the situation. But it would be slightly different in that the mood would be different. It would be a business mood, or it would be a friendship mood, or it would be a, you know, neutral mood. You know, if you said a guy that you didn't like showed up, you know, or whatever. You know, so that kind of a element would be there, but the form of it would basically look the same. That's why you can explain how to host an atiti, and you know how to host anybody. You know what I'm saying? Because the principle is the same, but it says details. You know, it's like, okay, then that's a Brahmin. Now if there's a Kshatriya Vaishya guest shows up, but they're fed after that Brahmin, because everything goes on them. And if it's a friend, then they would help you taking care of the respective guests. And then after you've taken care and they're resting and taking, and they're satisfied, then you and your friend will go and sit down and eat, because that's the rasa. You know, if you sit your friend with a respected guest, then your relationship with your friend on that level can't be tasted. Mm. You know, like that. And then, but because you are respecting a guest, then your friend naturally, to manifest that friendship, would assist you in respecting that guest. Mm. Then your mood as friends is maintained and cultivated, and at the same time both of you have the benefit of taking care of a special guest. So the whole thing is rasa. That's the point. This pragmatism without considering rasa as only economic gain is not a full picture. It's great for Vaishyas, but you see what they've done to the world. The first world means Vaishyas. The bourgeois. Yeah. And you see what they're doing to the world. Yeah. Because they only consider what's good for economics. Destroy cultures, destroy countries, destroy families. It doesn't matter as long as it's still economically progressive. Okay, we break down the family unit, make all the teenagers independent from their parents, and all that, so they're also now, you know, consumers. Because before it was, you know, the father, if he said we're buying it, they buy it. And if they don't buy it, they don't buy it. You know, because they only have so much cash, they don't, you don't want to take any risk. Then you create, you know, your credit market and all this and that. Then it's like maybe they'll take the risk, but still father says. Then you break it down. The women can do their thing. They want to do their thing. So now they're on the market. So now more money can be spent. Then, but the teenagers still do what the parents, they get the stuff for them. They buy their clothes from them. No, but you make them an independent, then it works. So as long as it's functioning in economics, it doesn't matter. It completely breaks down. But as soon as it breaks down so badly that people become neurotic, they don't function right, they can't work at jobs, the jobs don't work now, the businessmen don't have proper people to hire, and then the people just loiter around in the street, work off of welfare, they steal, they, you know, do all these things that drop the character so badly, then they get worried because economics goes down. Only for that. They couldn't care less about the family. But they'll present it, oh yes, we have to do something, you know, the family unit and this and that. Because they want credit. They want to make profit from both sides. They want to be seen as religious, all this, and at the same time they want to make a profit. So that's the difficulty, if that's the point. So that's why the Vedic system is your Brahmas, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas have to be trained, because they are the leaders of society. The economics is coming out of the Vaishyas, the administration out of the Kshatriyas, and the knowledge out of the Brahmas. So if they're correct and they're working together as a team, then your common person is very satisfied, they're taken care of.
Now they're bought by the Vaishyas.
The intellectuals, yes,
and the
everything is
run
by
that. Completely
the
hands
and the... Yeah. It means all your science and all this is all by what's going to be... Because there's some people they have just do research because they may come up with something new. If the guy's got that good of a brain that they come up with some unique things that might prove in the future to be economically useful, then they're supported. But then once things are dreamt up, then those things that'll make money, those things are then grants are given for that. You know, so therefore it's all, like you said, it's all bought. You know, the person gets his spot as election because of the lobbyists paying money for the campaign.
Basically, culture like music, dance, drama, and education were supported by kings with grants,
mm-hmm.
because they weren't supposed to make money from them.
Mm-hmm.
But nowadays, if something doesn't make money, it's not supported.
Right.
It has to generate its own income, and so you know the taste of the general mass of people is not so high.
Mm-hmm.
And so what comes as culture, music, dance, theater,
mm-hmm.
movies, whatever, it sex and so on and so forth, because that's what people appreciate. And so then what was previously used to elevate the consciousness of the people becomes now the medium for
degrading them, yeah.
From the degradation.
That's fine, yeah. Yeah, it's really unfortunate. So that's the idea, probably, when the cultural revolution, where people actually understood what the culture is, what is human nature, what is human value, how to operate it, so that people could be satisfied by addressing their actual own inherent nature and then functioning. Because we see in the Vedic culture, it's not that the business people weren't wealthy. In Gujarat, the Somnath temple was raided 17 times by the Persians over that side. You ever see that? I don't know if I saw a picture of the wealth when the Shah of Iran, when the Khomeini and all those came in and took over, because he was out of the country. I think he was in England or someplace. They took over, and so then they took all everything and raided the palace and that, and they put out on display the wealth. It was immense. You know, and that's just probably part of what's left of what they stole off the Somnath temple. You know, all the gold domes and all that. And 17 times they just completely replaced it. Like that. So the wealth was unlimited. So that's the thing. The Vedic culture is the only thing that actually will satisfy everybody. Because now it's like Vaishyas can be satisfied if they can completely exploit all the other three orders. Or Kshatriyas, they can exploit them all, the intellect. Like that. But the Vedic was is nobody's exploited, everybody's fully taken care of.
Did you read about this diamond that they found here in India?
What, recently or previously?
Yeah, just recently. India is the richest country in the world. There's some guy who found three diamonds this big, and even, you know, they are worth more than the whole brutal national product of United States and England put together. And they couldn't even buy it if they wanted. They don't have the money to buy these diamonds.
Really?
Yeah, so now India is the richest country in the world.
Oh,
where
yeah.
did they find them?
Some Indian guy, you know, nobody found them in his cellar. He's excavating his cellar. And
that means they were already found before.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. These were previous family wealth.
Yeah.
And that was just what his family had.
Yeah.
And the government took it?
Yeah. Basically, yes. I think he died and he left it to the government, yeah.
Oh, okay. Wasn't they gave him a compensation? Yes, we'd like to give you only 500 rupee now. In consideration.
It's just amazing. It was a text on him. Oh, I couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
I didn't see anything on BBC.
No, but I didn't go to the link that they referred to, but there was a link for some.
Yeah, you should check.
Or did to be.
Yeah, it was on Tamil, but it was on some national news channel. But I don't think they're very eager to even to propagate that news.
Forward it to me, please.
Huh?
Forward it to me.
Yeah.
Means, and that's just what one guy found in his basement, you know, let alone previously. So it's like the Kohinoor diamond. You know, I think it's one of the crown jewels now.
Yeah,
but it was 900 carats, its original size. Mm-hmm. And then it kept getting cut and recut and recut.
This diamond is 42,000 carats.
Oh, well, a little bigger than Kohinoor.
So it's cut?
No.
Not
42,000. Yeah. It's just
mind
blowing. And there are three. Yeah. I think together they're 42,000.
That's actually a big temple.
Keep a lot of rabbits happy with that one. The amount of carrots that are there.
And this what's his name, Vijayapaya, Vajpayee, he said something like, you know, everyone was asking, what are you going to do with all that money? Oh, we're just going to keep it, and if something comes up, we'll spend. Very cool.
Yeah.
Can I ask a question about guests?
Yes.
This guy asked me before. The story of the old Mangala Thakur. The old Mangala follows that Brahmani who's taking water from the well to her house. And then her husband receives him as a guest. And he's, you know, as an Atiti, he's worshipped as Buddha's God, and he says that I want your wife. And the Brahmana tells his wife, and because it's his instruction, she agrees. Can you explain that?
The person who asked you a question, what's his purpose?
He wanted to understand. He's a respected member of the GDC.
But I mean, what would be the angle on it?
I suppose people ask him as well, and he just didn't know how.
No, I'm saying because there's many angles you could look at it from. Mm-hmm. I mean, the general principle is that the guest then is taken care of, and all their desires are fulfilled. So, taking that principle, you could look at it in that way. But the point is atiti is a very specific definition, that it's a qualified brahmana who comes unasked and stays one night. Mm-hmm. That's a titi, like that. Though, that's all you're obliged to is one night. Though, if a host keeps in a titi for three nights, then each night his benefits increase, like that. But he's only obliged really to take care of him one night. That's an atiti. So just anybody who just rolls in is not an atiti. Mm-hmm. They may be kind of dealt with in that category, but they're like a sub, like that. So therefore, here, Nirvana Mangal is a very qualified Brahma. Like that. Now one may say, oh, he's all prostitute, this, that. But the point is there's more beyond morality that creates the individual. Because you are dealing with the material world, you're dealing with the senses, you're dealing with many things, and it says even a person of great intelligence can be distracted if the sense goes in that direction. So that element's there. You have to see what is their knowledge, what can they do, what is their actual consistent practice, like that. That is then you can... something. So then we see he was quite a qualified person. Then he's come. Then you have that element of taking care of the guest, and so it stays within there. Then the detail that happens to be his wife, then you look at it from the wife's side, whatever it is the husband says, then if she follows, she gets no reaction, he gets a reaction. So for the wife, because it's there, then it's duty. So from hers, if she's fulfilling the husband's wish, so therefore she remains her chastity. Now whether there'll be a reaction for that on the husband's part, that's another question. You know, whether that is would be considered an appropriate or important thing for offering to a guest or not. But it must have been a situation where they felt it was appropriate. Because if someone else, then they might have said no. You know what I'm saying? So there's many, many angles to analyze. That's why I was asking, what is their purpose that they are asking? What is the doubt that came up? You know, what is the angle that it's looked from?
Because the question is, and I feel that I have the answer as you speak, is that the proper response in Vedic culture, that someone comes, an Atithi, and you're ready to give them anything, including your own life?
Basically, the principle is there, but it wouldn't come up. Mm-hmm. You know, we only hear of this one example of it. So therefore, it must have been seen that the person, the qualification, and everything about it was something that the host, you know, didn't mind. You know, you hear things like this about giving up all the wealth, or this, or that, so many other things you hear of. So this is the only one where you hear of this. I don't know of any other story where this is there. You know, I mean, there was that thing of that one disciple of Ramanuja and the local Vaishya. But that was asking, and they would ignore it because they have no obligation. But in this case, so there must have been consideration in seeing the situation that they decided like that, because you're dealing here with a Brahmin also who knows the scriptures, and him looking at the situation, who he's dealing with, what's the mood and all that, you know, the nature of his wife and so many different things, and he must have felt confident that there would be nothing would go wrong in that. You know, if he felt that it would make the wife unchaste or this or that, then I'm sure that he would have, you know, discussed it in a slightly different way. You know, so it's just there in the story as a side element. It's not something there to gain from. This is what devotees should add into their life. When you talk about hosting, then things like Shibi and Ranti Dave, these are the examples of the extent that someone is going to go through, you know, for pleasing the guest, you know, like that. Or someone who's come with a desire. These are more. That's not taking. There, it is pointed out, is what the thread of that story is the Bilva Mangal Thakur's, you know, just his progress and his spiritual development and his focus on attaining the Supreme. That he had focus, but it was misdirected. And you only get that focus from proper training. Right? You don't have that focus without some kind of background and some good karma. But then by the grace of the prostitute, it changed. In other words, by the Dharma Shastra, it says good advice can be taken from anyone. Like that. So even from the prostitute, he can take good advice. So she said, if you had that focus, you know, because she has men coming to her all the time. And it's just some sensual, you know, they're just sensually attached. And so therefore they come to the prostitute to fulfill that need. But they don't have any specific focus on her. It's just, it's business, you know. So someone that has such focus that they have so much attachment for her. And for the prostitutes, it's business. So it's like, why would you be so attached? You're too focused. You have too much determination. You have too. It's over the top. It's not, as we mentioned here, you bring your dress, speech, and thoughts in line inconsistency. It says, what I am, and the reason that people come to me, what you're doing is inconsistent with that. You have the, what you, how you are behaving and focusing is consistent with a sadhu who is focused on the Supreme Lord. They would do anything to get their sadhya, you know. So she was saying, therefore you should now take your focus, your dharana, and put the Lord there as your folk meditation rather than me. And so then, because he's intelligent, just as she said that, it created such a revolution in his heart, means he's a very qualified person. Otherwise someone else said, no, you're just so nice and beautiful. And okay, it doesn't matter. They're getting their money, so what do they care? Guy's so stupid. You know, it's a waste of time, but you know, what, you know, she's not going to complain. So, but he moved on. And so she doesn't feel I lost a customer. She feels that, you know, this person is now rightly situated. you know. And so then from that, there's still that slight little attraction in the heart, because he may have given up this particular prostitute, focused on the Lord, but the principle of womanhood is still has some attraction for him. So then by this, then we see that it's there, and then because the opportunity is given, this is another point that's there. They could have also possibly seen that his purity was such that he had the desire, but he didn't actually have that conviction. So by offering, it would go away. That is also a way of doing, because sometimes by offering, it'll go away. You ever heard the way how Shivananda became a brahmachari? Like that. That was the arrangement of his sister-in-law.
Praha Shivananda. Who was Shivananda?
I think it's Rishikesh.
Oh, famous yogi.
Yeah, the big yeah, that one. Because very intelligent and very, you know. As a kid, when he was 16, he had attachment for a prostitute. He'd always go see her. And because they need money, so then he'd start stealing from the house, because he was living, I guess the father was gone, so the older brother was then taking care. He was the head of the family and was raising him. And so then his older brother was married, so his wife, then he was like son. And she used to, so he used to steal her ornaments. So one day she caught him and says, you know, what is this for? You know, and he explained, you know, because I guess there was a really good relationship, very close. So he just revealed that this is a prostitute and he's so attached to her and he has to give her money and this and that. And she said, okay, I'll give you this under one condition. He says, what's that? Is that you give it to her in a special way that I'll describe it to you. Like that. And she said, and he said, okay. He says, you go to the prostitute's house and you tell her that you brought her a very nice gift, you know, very nice expensive jewelry, but, you know, in a well-lit room, that she's supposed to stand there naked and she has to bend down, you know, and put her hands between her legs, and you have to hand that to her. Like that. So then he agreed, and when he did that, then he could see exactly what he was, what he was exactly paying, and it freaked him so badly that he just freaked and walked out of the house and went to the forest, and from that time he was something else, like that. So that the sister loved it. She just knew that, you know. She was trying to explain to him, women aren't so wonderful, why you're so attached, why you're ruining your life like this, they're not worth it. You know, religiously dealing, but not to this extreme. They're not worth it, you know. So then, you know, but he couldn't understand. He says, okay, you really want to understand what women are, okay, do this. So then it is. So the prostitute understood. It's just too much. So sometimes that technique can work. So that's also, you don't know, because that's not the main point. So you don't also know what were all the considerations of that Brahmin. He could have understood that if I say yes, it may be such that, because the person doesn't expect it. It's just out of lust he says yes. But as soon as you, like that, then, right? You know, just if we're into these wild, you know, out of the ordinary stories. And a story I had heard, that there was a time of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, one of the sannyasis had gotten distracted by, like, sexual attraction. But he was the main preacher. And then it was brought up to Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. He said, just get him a prostitute, let him do his business, and then go out there and preach. Why you should stop his preaching, you know? So when the devotee heard that, then it just shocked him and woke him up. And then, you know, he gave up all interest in this way.
He'd also work with Vilamangala Thakur,
yeah,
because he became so ashamed that he took, yeah, out his eye.
Yeah, so that's the point, is that there's also that element, is that they know what they're doing. It's not. It didn't say what the qualification of the other Brahmin was, how expert he was, or the wife. You know, or you have that Alwar. Was he the one with the... Well, he had the girl that is there, disappeared, but there's another one that he... I don't know that he was married. He was living in a hut, you know, on the outskirts of town, in the garden. That was Tirumala. Oh, really?
As far as I know.
Okay, well, he was living in this garden, and he had written so many prayers, and, you know, that he was famous. And he was so detached, you know, not, you know, interested at all in sense gratification, that he was out picking flowers in his garden. And because he had such a nice garden, then this most famous of in the town, where is it, Sri Rangam, was it? Of all the prostitutes, then she was happened like to go sit in his garden, because it was such a nice garden, just sit and peaceful, you know, away from the hubbub and all these crazy suitors and all this kind of thing. So then she's there, and he's out picking flowers, and he's picking, and she's sitting in, right there in the bushes of flowers. And he's going, you know, this is, you know, nice flower, this flower, this is that flower. Then he gets to her face and goes, this is not a flower. And then he just went to the next, this is a flower, this is, like this. And she went, what do you mean this is not a flower? This is the best flower in town, kid. You know, like that. So she thought, okay, I'll get this guy. We'll see who's, you know, who's not interested.
In 3 days.
Yeah, in 3 days. So then she went one day, it was raining, heavy raining. So she went out, you know, dressed in a thin, scanty piece of cloth, you know, most likely white, you know, that's always the popular one. And it's raining outside, and she sat in the gardens and was singing his songs. You know, he's going, who's singing the songs out in the rain? Then he sees this girl, you know, drenched, standing in the rain. He called her in, come, sit on the veranda and all this. So then she came and sat there and that. And he's not attracted by all this thing. But then she started, you know, dealing, you know, what are you doing? He said, oh, your song's so nice. Oh, it's fun to be around and be close and run to some service and this. But while she's doing this, she's doing all the moves and mudras and everything for attraction. She knows what to do. Like that. So this went on for 3 days. And then at the end of 3 days, then he, you know, then she said, you know, as soon as she understood that he had come down to ground level and became attracted by her, then she immediately says, oh, I gotta go.
That's true.
Like that, yeah. So as soon as that, then he said, you know, where can I find you? And then she said what her name is, and like that. Then where you can find her. I think that was the point. In 3 days, I'll have you crawling my name.
Calling
my name. Yeah, so then she went back to her place, and these kind of prostitutes live in big forts, you know, with guards and this and that. Nobody gets in unless they look, you know, stinking rich, you know. So then he goes there, poor, wretched Brahmin, like this and that or whatever, and goes there, and, oh, I'd like to see this girl. And they just turfed him out on the street. So he was so much anxiety, he was going back and forth and walking, just calling her name. So then I don't know how much time went by, but very shortly after that, then a messenger from the prostitute was sent and said that she would like to see you. And he was so happy he went and all that. And so then he was escorted in, and then when he met her, he says, oh, you know, he says, you called for me. He says, yes. He says, you know, you've sent me such a nice, you brought such a nice gift. He says, gift? What gift? And she explained that this, I think it was a solid gold water pot, big water pot, not a small water pot, big water pot, heavy, you know, water pot. And he said, and then he was saying, who? What is that? Water pot? Gold? And then she said, yes, this man came and brought it and said that you sent this as a gift to her and that she should spend time with him because, you know, she shouldn't neglect him because, you know, it seems that he's poor. Like that. So he's saying, who is this guy? What does he look like? And he explained everything. And then he said, can I see the pot? And he saw the pot. And then everything clicked. The pot was the pot he used every day to bathe the deity. And the person who delivered the pot was the deity. Like that. So then that created the shock. He just immediately walked out and that was it. Never thought of it. So sometimes that kind of technique is used. Like that. So that's the whole point. Is bhakti is the main thing. The morality is there to keep you focused in the right direction. That's the real purpose of all the rules and regulations. It's not something else. So then the question would come up is that one would really have to know two things. One is, since it's a secondary point, it's not the story you've learned from. That would be one point. So that's not where you look to others where they are. That is the point that's being made. Second would be is because it's not dealt with, you can't really tell what's the situation, how much the Brahmin understood the nature of Bilva Mangal, that if he said yes, that he would get the reaction that he got like that. third thing would be is, what is the purpose of the person who originally asked the question? They want to know if they can go to somebody else's house and ask for their wife or what? You know what I'm saying? Or is it just part of hosting is that you offer your wife, you know? That's Eskimos do that. That's part of their culture. But,
Mongolians.
But otherwise, in, they're probably similar people. I think they look the same. Maybe same group. So it's a, so therefore it wouldn't be something from that side. No, because you don't hear of it any other place. Wives aren't mentioned. A nice place to sit, sweet words, you know, if you have something to eat, a place to rest. These are what it says. It doesn't mention other things. So therefore, one would then wonder, what is the purpose of asking? If it's just a matter of it seemed funny, and then you explain it and it's clear, fine. But one would have to see, is there some purpose behind it?
I think that was the, you just wanted to know how to
explain it. No, what I'm saying is the senior person, that's their lookout. Mm-hmm. But who's asked the question, mm-hmm. that they, mm-hmm. they had, what was their purpose? Mm-hmm. You know, because I find nowadays many times you ask them what the purpose is, and then you find that their question doesn't need to be asked. Mm-hmm. Or they're actually asking a totally different question. Mm-hmm. Like that. Okay, so then. Okay, so this will go next time through quite quick, because most of these are not dealt with in detail. What's happening? Is a storm happening?
Sounds like.
Wow. Okay, so we'll end here. Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Shri Prabhupada ki jai.